Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming on tonight for the first time in 2015 at the Sydney Institute, and thanks to the Gallipoli Club for providing this facility, and thanks to Annabelle Crabb, who makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She's well known, but I'll introduce her briefly. Annabelle is one of Australia's most popular political commentators. She's a Walkley Award winner and host of Australia's first dedicated political cooking show, Kitchen Cabinet. She writes for the ABC's online The Drum and has worked extensively in television and radio. She's a columnist for the Fairfax Media Papers on Sunday and has worked as political correspondent and sketch writer for The Advertiser, The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, as well as in London for a period. And she won a Walkley Award for a 2009 essay on Malcolm Turnbull, and she was Australia's 2011 Eisenhower Fellow. And today, Annabelle Crabb is here on the occasion of the publication of her most recent book, The Wife Drought, Why Women Need Wives and Men Need Lives. And the topic for the night's topic is The Wife Drought. Annabelle Crabb, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared. It's a pleasure to be back. Tonight I'm going to talk to you about housework, partly because I doubt that anyone has addressed the Sydney Institute on that precise subject before, and if I'm honest with myself, partly because in a diabolical corner of my soul, I dream of, merely by broaching the subject of housework, inciting a dispute in the Hedonism household about the dishes that will lead to a truly infinite exchange of correspondence that I can then enter into the Turner Prize as my own creation. I'm always looking for ways to enrage Jared. I toyed with the idea of being 3 minutes late this evening. Quickly discarded it on the grounds of unusual cruelty. Perhaps I'm running away with myself. Let me explain first why I want to talk about housework. When we consider the issue of gender equality, talk almost immediately turns to the workforce. Why are there fewer female leaders than male? Why are women 60% of the uni graduates and 45% of the middle managers, but only 10% of executives and only 1 or 2% of CEOs, depending on what Gail Kelly is doing at the exact time of calculation? Why are women underrepresented in federal politics and grievously underrepresented in the cabinet? Mothers, even more so, I should say. Men have been breeding like voles in the cabinet room for years and no one turns a hair. Christopher Pyne has 4 young children and Joe Hockey has 3 and nobody notices. But here's a pop quiz for you. In what year did the mother of a preschool age child first serve in the Australian cabinet? Answer? 2007. That's right, just 7 years ago. Thank you, Nicola Roxon. And when we consider these questions, the suggestions we come up with are all about the workplace too. Maybe we should reform Parliament to make it more polite. This one always baffles me, both because I can't see how you'd do it, and also because I'm not sure that that would actually serve as much of a chick magnet anyway. Maybe we should have quotas. Maybe we should encourage women to network together, slash mentor each other, slash lean in, slash stick their necks out whilst leaning in, if possible. When researchers look at workplaces and try to work out why women fall through the cracks, they look at the workplace itself for clues. Is there a blokey culture? Do they have meetings on the golf course? Is there an unconscious bias in the way appointments are made? Do women get sidelined when they have kids or sneakily made redundant whilst on maternity leave? Do they come back to work to find they've been assigned all the rubbish jobs and are now seated in the open plan area next to Halitosis Joe from accounts? But the truth is that none of this stuff can possibly make any sense until you look at what happens after the work day is ended, when you join the spheres of work and home together. It happens less often than you'd think, but when it does happen, things become very clear. Terence Fitzsimmons, a University of Queensland researcher, authored a PhD paper 4 years ago looking at leadership among Australian CEOs. He interviewed about 30 male and 30 female CEOs and asked all the normal questions about career progression, leadership styles and so on. But he did something unusual too. He asked them how they organised their domestic lives and relationships. And here's what he found. Of the 30 male CEOs he interviewed, 28 had children, and all 28 of those had a stay-at-home wife. Of the 31 women he interviewed, only 2 had a stay-at-home husband. Of the women CEOs who had children, about 2/3 of them, what it was, the rest having decided against it, or, as is often the case, simply got to the point in their lives and careers where they realised it just wasn't going to happen. Every single one of the CEOs who were mothers identified herself as the primary caregiver of her children. Of his interviews with CEOs, Fitzsimmons observed that, quote, many male respondents noted that being a family man had made a significant positive contribution to their career progression and ultimate selection as CEO. No female respondents made this connection. Now, none of this is exactly rocket science. Of course, a person with a spouse who takes care of stuff at home will be more free to prosper in the workplace. Yet the weird thing is that among all the reasons that we traditionally proffer for women's underrepresentation in politics, company boards and so on, blokey culture, bosses who don't promote women, women who don't lean in and so on, the factor no one at home remembering whether it's damn mufti day or not gets mentioned surprisingly little. Now, when I set out to write this book, I went on the hunt for statistics on the comparative rate of wife-having between men and women in Australia. If, as I suspected, having a wife, which I define as a spouse who either doesn't work at all in the paid workforce or who works part-time, if having a wife is a secret weapon in the pursuit of a serious career, then it would be helpful to know the hard data about who has one and who doesn't, right? Well, the strangest thing was that I couldn't find that figure anywhere. To me, it seemed like a really big issue if I had a buck for every time I heard a working mother say, you know, what I really need is a wife, then I would be an extremely wealthy person. But I couldn't find any statistics at all. In the end, I buttered up a very clever lady from the Australian Institute for Family Studies, and she applied her vast brain and swanky software to the 2011 census data. And this is what she found. Of full-time working fathers in Australia, 76% have what I call a wife, which is to say a spouse who either does not work in the paid workforce at all or who works part-time, thus leaving some flexibility to get to all the tasks in a modern household which require flexibility, whether it be running children around or being there for the waftily non-specific window in which the plumber has promised to call. But among full-time working mothers, the rate of wife-having is grievously lower. Only 15% of them have a spouse who works part-time or not at all. What does this mean? Well, take two, I don't know, let's say lawyers at a big firm. One is a man, one is a woman, they each have 2 children, a busy job, and an ambition to succeed, be promoted, and all the rest of it. They might be equally talented and equally ambitious, but the law of averages in Australia tells us that one of them is 5 times more likely than the other to have someone at home who can look after kids when they get sick, take Nana to her appointments, organise for the modem to be fixed, make sure there's a present for the school friend whose birthday party it is tomorrow, and so on. And if that doesn't make a difference to the potential of each of these people to go the extra mile at work, to excel and flourish, then I would be extremely surprised. housework is important, because if you're doing most of it, it does really and truly affect the way you function at work. So let's talk about housework. Let's take the visible from space view first, which delivers news that will not surprise you one bit. Women do more work in the home than men. This is true everywhere, although the phenomenon has different extremes in different countries. The country in which a randomly chosen female spouse has the best chance of a hand with washing up is Norway, where, according to the OECD, blokes put in 3 hours of domestic work a day as opposed to their wives who rack up 3.5. Then you get countries like Japan, where the average bloke does just an hour of chores, cleaning, childcare and so on, but finds that home ticks along okay because his wife does 5. Now, Australian women do an unusually high amount of housework and childcare, 5 hours and 11 minutes a day, according to the OECD figures, which is 11 minutes more than the Japanese lady for whom we were feeling sorry 10 seconds ago. But on the bright side, Mrs. Australia isn't married to Mr. Japan. She's married to Mr. Australia instead. And he does nearly 3 hours work a day in the home, lots less than his wife, granted, but lots more than his brothers in Mexico, Korea or Italy. One of the reasons that Australian men and women do more work in the home than their international counterparts is that we do not have a culture of low-paid domestic service. In the United States, for example, both men and women do less housework than we do, but they are also much more likely to have a representative of a social underclass helping out. Domestic workers in the US are 94% women anyway, so it doesn't mess with the gender statistics too much. But outsourcing housework brings in a lot of other variables, specifically race. Domestic carers who are white, for instance, in the United States earn a median wage of $12 an hour, while black and Latino workers earn $10 an hour, and Asians $8.33 on average, according to research done several years ago by the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Now, on one hand, it's nice to see the American ladies getting cut some slack in the domestic department. On the other, it's pretty awful that that slack gets taken up by workers whose pay rate depends, at least in part, on the colour of their skin. Women do more housework than men do. This is the big picture everywhere. Across all of the countries of the OECD, men average 141 minutes a day of work in the home, and women average 273, twice as much, basically. Now, the last 50 years have brought about extraordinary changes for women. At the beginning of the 1970s, about 40% of women worked, and now that's up around 60%. This movement of women into the workplace is considerable, but it has not been counterbalanced by men moving in the opposite direction. And women did not decrease their overall contribution to housework to reflect the other jobs they'd taken on, they just added to the portfolio. In fact, between 1992 and 2006, for example, women increased the time they spent on childcare by nearly 20%. And in the United States, where time use data is available going back to the 1970s, it's reported that an average full-time working mother in America today spends more hours per week in intensive one-on-one play with her child than her mother did with her in the 1970s, even where her mother did no paid work at all. Now, defenders of the traditional breadwinner homemaker model argue that the lopsided distribution of paid and unpaid work within a couple makes economic sense. This is the system called exchange bargaining, in which one person, commonly the husband, earns money and supports another person, usually the wife, who in return agrees to take responsibility for bathroom grout and the Easter bonnet parade and all the rest of it. And there certainly are appealing aspects to this arrangement. Nobody is doubling up on tasks too much, and there's a fairly clear rule of thumb as to who does what. And it's true that if you add up the total number of hours that everybody's worked, including all paid and unpaid work, the total number of hours done by men and women in couple families tend to be about the same. In the traditional family structure, he will take care of earning the income, plus lawn mowing, plus the removal of certain crawling pests, and it will all add up to about the same amount of time as she is spending on cooking, cleaning, and childcare. What's really interesting, though, is what happens in those families when circumstances change. What happens in the circumstances when women move into paid work and men move out of it? If the exchange bargaining model is to be believed, everybody should swap round tasks so that things stay roughly even, right? But that's not what happens. According to the Australian time use survey data, men do, on average, between 15 and 20 hours of housework a week, no matter whether they work full-time, part-time, or not at all. Men who are not in the labour force at all do about 20 hours of housework. Part-time working men do about 15 hours, and full-time working men do an average of 16. Why do men who work full-time do slightly more housework than men working part-time? I do not know. Women, however, are a completely different story. A stay-at-home wife with a working husband does, on average, 42 hours of housework a week. That is, as the numerate among you will instantly have discerned, more than twice as much as even a man who does no paid work at all. But as she takes on more hours of paid work, a woman will ease back on the housework. A woman who works full-time does on average just 25 hours of domestic work. Still more work than the average not employed man, but a whole lot less than a not employed woman. But men seem to be governed by an invisible national domestic award system. 20 hours a week. An average Australian man will do about 20 hours of housework a week if he works full-time, or if he works part-time, or if he doesn't work at all, or if his wife's at home, or if she isn't. In fact, there are only a handful of life events that change the amount of housework that men do to a significant and broadly observed degree. Moving out of home is one of them. A man aged between 20 and 49 who moves out of his parents' home to live either alone or in a share household dramatically increases the time he spends cooking and shopping. Another is divorce. According to Janine Baxter, a leading academic in this field who analysed data from a survey project of several thousand Australians called Negotiating the Life Course, divorce immediately adds about 10 hours a week to a man's domestic workload. Divorce means something quite different for women, however, who do about 6 hours less a week after divorcing their husbands. And what about the arrival of children? Surely all that extra washing, sterilising, shopping for nappies and childproofing the house and so on must make a difference to the domestic workload. Baxter's research found that the birth of a first child jacked up a woman's housework load considerably. She did about half as much again after her first child's birth, and more again after the birth of a second child. The birth of a first child, however, generates negligible extra housework for men, and the arrival of a further child after that actually reduces the amount of time the supplier of its Y chromosome spends doing housework. Baxter, puzzled, advances two theories. She says it may be that additional children help to cement an already traditional division of labour in many households. Or it may be that additional children lead men to increase their hours of paid work in order to compensate for the increased expenditure associated with more children, or to compensate for their wives' reduced time in paid labour. Indeed, while women step back from paid work when they give birth to their first child, new fathers tend to increase their work rate outside the home. Men increase their work week by about 4.5 hours on average when their first child is born. So women shrink their housework hours when they work full-time, increase them when they have children, they respond rather elastically, in other words, to all the changes life can bring. But men pretty much keep doing what they're doing. Now let's have a quick look at the busiest households of all, which are the ones with children aged under 15 years. Now, households with a dad and mum and kids are remarkably predictable. 90% of the dads work, the majority of them full-time. They are at work for a towering average of 52 hours a week. They do, you guessed it, around 20 hours of housework a week. And these guys will continue to do around 20 hours, whatever happens. But mum's patterns are quite different. A stay-at-home mother with a full-time spouse will typically do about 65 hours of housework a week, once you include childcare. When she moves into part-time work, she drops that back to 50 hours. When she works full-time, she'll drop it again to 41 hours. That is a whole 24 hours worth of housework that she will chop out of the week to make room for paid work. What happens to that day's worth of work? Because the dads don't change their habits much in response. On average, they will respond by increasing their domestic workload by 35 minutes a week to help compensate for those lost 24 hours. It's a messier house, or someone else is helping, it's a mystery. But there's another factor that has an even more intriguing effect on division of labour in the Australian home, and that is share of earnings. The question of who earns more, in other words, the historical male breadwinner model assumes that men will earn all of the household income and that women will do most or all of the housework. We've just seen what happens when a woman increases her hours of paid work. She does much less housework, and her husband counters by doing a little bit more. When you look at how women change their behaviour according to how much they earn instead of how many hours of paid work they do, you notice something absolutely fascinating. Baxter and Belinda Hewitt, in their 2012 paper Negotiating Domestic Labour, Women's Earnings and Housework Time in Australia, analysed information from Australian households. They specifically looked at the pattern of women's housework plotted against their contribution to the household's total weekly earnings. They looked at women in couple families only. No one would be surprised, after all, to learn that single mothers do all the housework in their homes. Here's what they found. On average, women do 17 minutes less housework a week for every 1% extra they contribute to the household budget. So if a husband earns $99,000 and his wife goes out and gets a casual job that pays $1,000, she will lop 17 minutes off her weekly housework load. Another 1% of contribution ensures a further 17 fewer minutes of work around the house and so on. This so far is a rather beautiful demonstration of bargaining theory. Paid work is exchangeable for unpaid work. If you do more of one, you'll do less of the other. But this pattern holds only until the woman's contribution reaches 66.6% of total household income. Once she starts earning more than that, which is to say she becomes clearly the principal breadwinner of the home, she starts increasing her housework load again. Once the woman is firmly established as the family's breadwinner, in other words, she starts behaving in exactly the opposite manner from what the bargaining model would predict. As she earns more from paid work, she resumes more and more work around the house. This is a pattern that is unique to Australia. The researchers twisted and turned and put in and took out factors to try and work out if this wasn't some sort of glitch in the calculations. But it held true and distinguished Australia from all sorts of other countries. That's quite weird. Why would a woman making a bigger contribution to the paid work in any given household also feel obliged to increase the amount of unpaid work she does at the same time. And why does 66.6 serve as the trigger point for everything in a household suddenly to change? What is it, the number of the laundress or something? It's very odd. The explanation, the only one available really, is that in Australia our expectations about who will probably be the breadwinner and who will probably be the homemaker are still deep set and powerful. And when a woman tips that up by earning more than her husband, she will often seek to compensate for that in other ways, like by hanging on to more of the housework. And here's what we know about attitudes. This again is taken from Baxter's research. Australians were asked over the decades to agree or disagree with this statement. It is better for the family if the husband is the primary breadwinner outside the home and the wife has primary responsibility for the home and the children. In 1986, 56% of men agreed with this proposition. By 2001, it had gone down to 30%. But by 2005, it had bounced right back up again to 41% of men agreeing with that proposition. Similarly, among women, in 1986, 33% of us agreed that it was better for everyone if we stayed home. By 2001, that was down to 19%. But by 2005, it was right back up again to 36%, higher than it had been in the 80s. Instinct tells us that attitudes have been modernising steadily over the past few decades, but the reality is that we're more conservative than we think on this stuff. But back to housework. Why does it remain such a female domain? Well, one thing we don't talk about all that much because it interferes with the equality argument is that men and women often have differing ideas about what constitutes an acceptable degree of cleanliness in an average home. New York Magazine's Jonathan Chait, a writer and home dad, in 2013 confronted this situation rather boldly in his essay entitled A Really Easy Answer to the Feminist Housework Problem. Here's what he wrote. Viewing housework inequality as entirely a phenomenon of exploitative men free-riding off of female domestic labour makes sense only if you think men derive equal enjoyment from a cleaner and neater home, he wrote. The assumption of most of the feminist commentary surrounding household chores assumes that there is a correct level of cleanliness in a heterosexual relationship and that that level is determined by the female. I think a little cultural relativism would improve the debate. Chait himself, by way of declaring his stakeholder interest in this matter, disclosed that in college he had lived, quote, in a group house with newspapers for carpeting and pizza boxes stacked to the ceiling. Since marriage, though, he and his wife have settled on a standard, a bit neater than he would keep it, and a bit messier than she would ideally like. The Canadian writer Stephen Marsh enlarges upon the theme in a recent New York Times piece, rather excitingly entitled The Case for Filth, in which he too agitates for grime. The ancient Romans would have found Renaissance Europeans disgusting beyond belief, as their Muslim contemporaries did. And certainly my grandmother would find my house filthy, Marsh argues. The standards have changed. There exists no agreed-upon definition of what has to be done in a household. The solution to housework wars is not only clear, but refreshingly easy, in Marsh's view. Housework is perhaps the only political problem in which doing less and not caring are the solution, Marsh writes. 50 years ago, it was perfectly normal to iron sheets and to vacuum drapes. They were necessary tasks. The solution to the inequality of dusting wasn't dividing the dusting, it was not doing the dusting at all. Now, there is one final cultural barrier that tends to keep the genders on either side of the housework divide. It's about competence and perceptions of competence. You know, in the workplace, anti-discrimination laws forbid a man to stand up and say, you know what, women women make really bad accountants. But there is nothing preventing a woman, and indeed this happens every day, from saying to her friends at the school gate, never trust a man to do the laundry. The Mere Male column in New Idea magazine has been going for 65 years. The theme, women writing in with their favourite stories about how rubbish their husbands are at basic household tasks, has remained unchanged over that time. And they still get plenty of traffic. It's a hell of a wind-up you got going there, Jared. A vast slice of the output of the advertising industry is predicated on the assumption that men are inept at housework. Bumbling dads who don't know how to put nappies on or cannot be relied upon to boil an egg are an advertising staple. And this is what, because while incompetence in the domestic sphere for a woman is a source of shame, for a man it is thought adorable and entirely natural. In the 4 series of Kitchen Cabinet I've made, only one person has really steadfastly refused to be a guest, and that's Julia Gillard. Her reason is that she is not a cook and would feel awkward even vaguely pretending that she was. And to be honest, I kind of understand her reservations, given the national uproar that ensued when she was inadvertently photographed next to an empty fruit bowl. Can you imagine the reaction had she buggered up an entire meal on camera? And yet, barely a mention is made when Joe Hockey, a generous and charming host, I hasten to note, steps into his own kitchen on camera and is genuinely flummoxed when asked to locate the knife drawer. Personally, I find housework boring. I am very much, in my own life, a proponent of the controlled filth approach. But the significance of housework I find fascinating. What shapes our lives at home cannot help but shape our lives at work. It is impossible to understand the latter until you understand the former. And I hope for this reason you will forgive me for spending this entire half hour moaning about the housework. Thank you.
Well, thanks to Annabelle Crabb. Janet Grundy's got copies of The Wife Drought, and I'm sure Annabelle would be happy to sign a copy after the event. We now go on to the top of the hour. I don't know about you, but then I'm heading home to do the washing up, so I'll be leaving in a hurry. So let's just start with Kitchen Cabinet. You've had occasion to have a bit of a snoop inside the rooms of houses and of both male politicians and female politicians. I mean, how do they stack up? Who's the cleaner? I mean, I think from memory you had quite a bit of a look at Joe Hockey's bed sheets, I think. In an entirely proper way. But, I mean, were they all at that standard or some worse?
Jared is kindly referring to the moment when the camera visiting Joe Hockey's home away from home in Canberra fell upon his Manchester. You know, his bedroom, which he kindly allowed us access to in, as Joe says, a very proper way, looks kind of like a teenage boy's room. I mean, this is the house that he... proving that he's a very shrewd choice as treasurer. He bought this house in Canberra in 1997 and immediately started renting rooms out to his colleagues at a reasonably stiff rate, as far as I could gather, which I think took care of the mortgage. The house, I think, cost about $29.95 when he bought it, because the Prime Minister just cleaned out the public service. It's now worth a bajillion, I know, because I checked the other day, and the house next door sold for $2 million. Anyway, he let us have a look through, and he had bought the bed sheets himself, and they were a rather fetching set of Bart Simpson bed sheets. they have since, as I understand it, been burned by Mrs. Hockey. Although I thought that Bart Simpson bed sheets would probably be about as firm a guarantee of spousal fidelity as have. But anyway, there was not a lot of housework going on, I think, in general in that house. It was kind of like a... It was like a man-topia, that house. It was sort of Bob Baldwin and Ross Cameron and Joe and Brendan Nelson up until he started struggling with the rent and moved into the shed for 8 years. That's where he lived when he was leader of the opposition and when he was defence minister and when he was education minister. And very sadly, it appears that it's a proper shed, not a studio flat or anything like that. And Joe, to his remorse, later discovered that it had enough power to run either the light or the heater, but not both at the same time. But I think Brendan always loved pain, so I think it would quite suited him. Anyway, on the broader question of politicians make incredibly atypical spouses in just about every respect. And, you know, political spouses are... to make a serious point, like an invisible suspension bridge running under democracy, right? And one of the reasons I think we don't discuss enough why women are underrepresented in federal politics is that they do not get the same sorts of spouses as the men get. And this is actually a really quite a serious issue, because for a lot of women who go into federal politics, and federal politics is difficult because it obliges you to travel, you know, about 20 weeks of the year at least, more if you become a minister. If you want also to have a family at the same time, then you need to find a spouse who's really prepared to be a single parent a lot of the time. And female spouses, wives, have been... picking that up and coping with it for a very long time. But there are precious few chaps who are up for that gig. And so that's why you find that women politicians tend, pound for pound, to have fewer children and are much more likely to be childless than male MPs. And if you are a lady politician who comes from Perth, then there is no way that you are having children at the same time. I went through and checked. I could not find one lady politician from Perth in the Senate or the House of Reps who had served as an MP or senator whilst having young children. They either don't have children at all, like Julie Bishop or Michaelia Cash, or they wait until their children are older, like Carmen Lawrence and a bunch of others. But it's funny, isn't it, to think that there's a whole geographical area of Australia that has a particular sort of representative just because life is incredibly difficult for women to juggle those sorts of absences. So I have a great deal of respect for parliamentary spouses. There's a very interesting story about Anna Burke, the former speaker who accidentally won the seat of Chisholm in the 1998 election. She had, you know, in that sort of rah-rah way of union organisers who go and run for a not very winnable Labour seat, you know, it's a sort of gesture to the movement. She ran for the seat of Chisholm, which was, at the time she nominated for it, held by Michael Waldridge, who was then the Health Minister. Waldridge then smartly decamped to another seat, and she won the seat to her horror and to the horror of her husband. They'd been expecting to start a family. She did go on to have a baby 2 years later, and in so doing became only the second woman since Federation to give birth to a baby while serving as a member of the House of Representatives. Only the second. And that was in 2000 when she had that baby. And her husband, who was a paramedic at the time, she had, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks off and then went back with the baby to the House of Reps. Nobody knew what to do with her, or the kid. And her husband applied to his employer and said, listen, I'm going to need to take probably a year of parental leave. And they said, well, you can't do that. That's only for women. And he said, well, it says here parental leave and I appear to be a parent, so what's the problem? He had a lot of trouble because he was the first person in that organisation who was a man who had asked for parental leave. And he went on to become a very good political spouse, but he was a bit of a trailblazer. Anyway, so that's my general views on politician spouses.
Thanks. So, question there.
Do we know anything at all about what happens in the invisible control group of same-sex couples?
Ah, I would love that information. Now, the time use data that is so useful, so when you're asking people how much housework they do, right, there are different techniques that through which the data is created. You can ring up people and ask them, and what happens then is that you get a wildly off-beam assessment. You know, when people are asked to report how much housework they do, they invariably inflate it. Everybody says that they're doing more housework than they are. There's this great study of a study in the US in about the 80s where people were asked how much housework they did, but they also filled out a diary at the same time, and it turned out that everybody was inflating their own efforts by about 20 hours. Unfortunately, some of the data collection surveys on which we base our knowledge of exactly what happens and quantifying the proportions of unpaid work, because it's incredibly difficult to measure since we don't do anything as sort of accountable as, you know, pay anyone for it. Unfortunately, those surveys were chopped back quite heavily in 2013 by the Gillard government. As a result, we're not getting quite as much information. There are many researchers weeping salty tears about this development, I assure you. I would love to have more information about, as same-sex couples begin more commonly to have children, how it works in those relationships. I do not know. I've asked a few people anecdotally, I would love to see further detail on that.
In a similar vein to that, is there a difference in the data between urban metro areas and then rural regional context? I'm thinking
the difference in the data between urban areas and regional areas.
I haven't really looked at that actually, so I couldn't give you a steer. I know that there are differences along ethnic lines, certainly. I did a session with George Megalogenis in Melbourne a few months back, and he was talking about his own experience. He's done quite a bit of research in this area too, but he talked about his own experience growing up in a kind of like a migrant community, I guess, where the kind of joint community childcare was much more of a thing. I think the concept of it taking a village to raise a child is not an especially predominant one at the moment. I wonder if that's where we next move with this field, by the way. I suspect that public liability concerns would play a certain role, but I'm afraid I can't help you on the geographical question that you raise. I'm sorry. Yes, Anne?
Workplace conditions are truly against women in many cases, but that jump in women's belief about whether it's okay for the man to be the what does this parallel sort of newfound feeling in the community that young children need special nurturing, the case you gave of a mother spending more time with children in more recent years than in the 70s, how much this goes back to the mentality in women to want to nurture their children as well now more so?
Well, sure.
Yeah, I mean, did you find out that this is affecting a younger generation?
Well,
for positive reasons, they'd rather be out of the workforce with their children.
Well, I think, I mean, there's the potential, I suppose, that that young women have a look at how things are panning out for the sort of superwoman generation, I suppose. And I expect that is partially what influences that sort of uptick of a kind of conservative approach to division of labour. You've got a generation or two of women who were all about having it all and then worked out that they were also doing it all at the same time and then got kind of incredibly tuckered out. I suspect that influences that change in attitude. As far as younger women go, I mean, the interesting thing about the gender wage gap is that it's sort of almost disappeared in the Generation Y generation. But then again, they haven't really, as a group, got onto the breeding yet. That's really where the difference happens. And there's a really strong pattern that exists still in Australia that tells us that for women who work, the experience of having a child means absolutely different things for what that experience means for men. So NATSEM put together this sort of really interesting piece of modelling a couple of years back, where they modelled the experiences of a 26-year-old average man and an average woman starting out today on a career that was 40 years duration and in an average job. And they modelled the outcome as follows. The young man could look forward to earning something like with exactly $2 million over the course of that 40-year career, and that would go up to $2.5 million if he had children, whereas for the young woman, she could look forward to earning $1.9 million, so nearly the same as the guy over the course of that career, but that would go down to $1.3 million if she had children. And there is an unbelievable amount of really, really interesting research data, and it's all based on these sort of diabolical sort of Stanford University experiments where they get people in and ask them questions pretending that it's about something when really it's about a gender thing. I love those experiments where they lie to people. It's terrible, I know, but it's really clear that men who are parents are thought to be more reliable, more promotable, more likely to have leadership qualities and more competent as well than women who have children. For women who are parents, it goes exactly the other way. They're thought to be less reliable, less competent, and so on. So while I think things are changing a bit over the generations, there's still that sort of hard bedrock of assumption, which is what drives a lot of this imbalance, I think.
Yes. Question.
Why is it, do you think, that in Australia women decide to have less home help?
Okay, let's stop it there. So just picking up from the podcast, why in Australia do women think it's desirable to have less home help?
There's a couple of factors, I think. One is of availability of affordable home help. Because we have an award system, it is beyond the reach of most women to have significant home help. It's not the same in Asia, where you have a very different experience of women, particularly in the executive workforce. There are hugely different patterns there from the patterns here, and it's based... one significant reason, I think, is that there is a really great availability, high degree of availability of really cheap household help. Now, as I said, it's not unproblematic, but that is a really significant reason. Another reason is that, well, I mean, it's not a reason, it's a byproduct of the phenomenon that you mentioned in your question. Australia has a really unusually high rate of part-time work. The big change in women's working patterns since, you know, the 1960s is women moving into the workforce, but it's women moving into the part-time workforce. The actual proportion of mothers who work full-time is not massively different today from the way it was a few decades ago. What really has changed is the women who work part-time. And in fact, the 2011 census, one of the most adorable things that the Australian Bureau of Statistics does is every census they put together a portrait of the average Australian, right? And so they select the commonest gender, which since the late 70s has been female. I mean, in 1961, the average Australian was a 28-year-old Anglican clerk, and now the average Australian is a 37-year-old woman who, they go into ridiculous amounts of detail because they select the most common occupation, residence, cars. She's a 37-year-old woman with two children aged 6 and 8. She lives in a suburban area of a large metropolitan centre. She and her husband both work. They each drive a car. They have a 3-bedroom house. They pay $1,800 a week in a month in mortgage payments. She works. She's got a diploma in business management, but she works part time in retail because that's what helps her juggle the week. She works 32 hours a week, and one assumes she is stressed out quite a bit of the time. and the great thing about the ABS's account of this woman, which tells you everything you need to know both about averages and about our own internal sense of uniqueness, is the ABS's kicker to this little description of the average Australian, which says, although these are the commonest attributes of Australians, of the 20 million or however many people we surveyed on census night, not one single respondent had every single one of these attributes. Second part of your question is...
Part two is, if it, and even now you just said about, you know, the woman has the degree and she's doing retail, wouldn't it make more sense in Australian government to look at the deductibility of housekeeping or preschool costs or childcare costs to be able to get the woman into a full-time job where they could blossom
okay.
and bloom?
There's a question that... Would it make sense for governments to bring about deductibility of certain expenses to enable women to get out of the home?
Well, I'm sure it would make a certain amount of rudimentary horse sense, and I would look forward to seeing what Joe Hockey says when we raise that with him. Look, I actually think that we spend all this time looking at women, right, and the barriers that they face on the way into the workforce. And that's because, you know, this great transformative force that is feminism has taught us, I suppose, to evaluate these questions all in terms of, well, what are women up to? What frustrations are they facing? What barriers are there in the workforce for them on their way into it? What I think we don't pay anywhere near enough attention to is the barriers that block men's exits from the workforce. If you think about it, women have really adapted a huge amount over the last 50 years, changed the way they work, changed the way they live to accommodate extra responsibilities in the workplace and so on. Whereas men have kind of been left behind a little bit, and I often think that men get blamed for this whole phenomenon quite a bit, you know, horrible old blokes, you know, not hiring women and not helping with the dishes and so on. But they haven't really experienced the same transformative experience as women over that time. And in truth, there are incredibly powerful cultural barriers that prevent men from changing the way that they work when their lives change, which is what women do all the time. So something like, I'm probably going to get this, I think it's 45% of mothers work part-time in order to manage their work-life balance. 5% of fathers do. And look, there are huge arguments to be had about whether to what extent men would like to work more flexibly or would like to hang out with their children more. I mean, you know, some of them are quite relieved to go to a nice quiet place, I imagine. But I don't think we really find out very much. And if you have a look at, I mean, in a discussion like this, at some point someone is going to mention Scandinavia, so, you know, or that neck of the woods. Norway is a really interesting example, right? So in the 1970s, you know, they've done lots of sensible things, Norway, like, you know, invest their minerals boom into a sovereign wealth fund. Yes, well done, Norway. Thank you very much. But in the 70s, they noticed that despite their very generous parental leave programs that were available to men too, publicly funded, very generous, the take-up rate among men was really low. So they did something interesting. They kind of rejigged the structure of their parental leave scheme, and they said, okay, so we're going to fund, you know, however many months, you know, 10 months or something of paid parental leave, but we're going to make a big chunk of it only available to the family if it's the dad who takes it. So rather than they kind of turned, they used the impetus and momentum of that providing for the family urge, and they turned it towards men taking leave from work rather than doing what they do in Australia, which is take 2 weeks off, leave off if you're lucky, and then scurry back to work. And over the subsequent years, it has completely changed the way fathers conduct themselves. In Norway, it's really, really common, in fact, unremarkable for men to take parental leave. All the information suggests that spending time with a child soon after birth or for a protracted period of time makes them more involved parents down the track. And Norway is about as even a country for division of domestic labour as you can find anywhere in the world. Now, I don't think that that's a coincidence. And I think that it's very easy to say, well, look, how can a government fix this situation? How can a government provide, you know, incentives here or tax deductibility there to allow women to get, you know, cheaper home help? The other way you can do it is change people's expectations of who will do what. And I think that that is, to a very great extent, a matter of corporate leadership. You know, there are all sorts of flexible work policies now available across particularly very large firms. But there is still, to a very great extent, a cultural expectation that that is a measure that's been adopted for women, that that is something to help women into the workplace. And often that's great, it's fine, and you know, working flexibly is a really useful way to manage your work-life balance. There's this totally diabolical study that IBM did, which was fascinating but also evil in the sense that they did all these experiments with people to find their what they called break point. These researchers went and interviewed all of these IBM workers, and they worked out that the break point, which is to say the point at which a person gets so busy that they lose their mind, was something like, you know, I don't know, 56 hours a week for a person with two kids or whatever. The exact details escape me. They found that when that person was allowed to work flexibly, it added something like another 10 hours a week to their break point. That is to say, if they felt that they had some flexibility in how they organised their work day, they could get more work done before they went crazy. And, you know, I think it's why you see big companies now really looking at this flexible work idea. It's like, all right, okay, so you're going to be sitting up in bed working, you know, that's awesome. But anyway, so the fact that flexible work arrangements are still very commonly sort of marketed as a woman's thing, I think that I think that affects the take-up rate among men. I think that when people in a big company particularly make decisions about, you know, when they apply for leave or flexible work entitlements that they may or may not apply for, the evidence tells us that women are really good at asking for parental leave and really good at asking for flexible work. It's actually almost the only thing in the workplace that women are always better at asking for than men, right? Men are really bad at asking for less work. They're really good at asking for more money, more so than women. But I think that that is a real area where cultural change and a little bit of thought could make quite a lot of difference.
Annabelle, that's a good point to finish on because we're at the top of the clock. Many thanks, Manuel Crabb, tonight for a very sensible, a very thoughtful, and highly entertaining address to the Sydney Institute at the Gallipoli Club. So well done. We no doubt you'll be back again in the not too distant future. In the meantime, as I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of The Wife Drought, and I'm sure Annabelle would be happy to sign them. But for tonight, thank you and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.